New year, same old tricks from the Kremlin, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. The family of an American detained by Russia denies he's a spy, but that's not stopping Moscow from putting a familiar spin on his arrest.
There's no spies that are sort of more prized than catching U.S. intelligence, and that's the one that's being presented to the Russian public.
Also, the new year means a new president for Brazil.
So Bolsonaro is evidently going to be running his presidency via Twitter, very much a Trump-esque dynamic.
Plus, effective today, Jamaica bans plastic shopping bags, though most Jamaicans call them something else.
There's several local terms for them. Scandal bags is by far the most popular.
Scandal bags and much more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Welcome to 2019. New year, new beginnings. Well, not so much between the U.S. and Russia, as our first story suggests. The last couple of years have seen growing tension over Russia's efforts to influence the 2016 presidential election. There's been a feud over sanctions imposed against Moscow. Now comes news that Russia has detained an American on suspicion of espionage. His name is Paul Whelan. He was arrested on December 28th when, according to his family, he was attending a wedding in Moscow. Reporter Charles Maines is following the story in Moscow. Charles, let's talk about the timing of this announcement. Whelan went missing on December 28th. It was only yesterday, December 31st, that Moscow puts out this information about him. Why yesterday?
You can only take a guess as to why the timing of this. Why wait for 3 days? I suspect one theory may be that the Russian security services have had a really pretty terrible year. They've been in the news for botched operations. They've been outed for carrying out this attack against the Russian spy Sergei Skripal and his daughter, Yulia, in Salisbury in the UK. And so maybe this does show that they're still active and that they're sort of manning the home front here. And certainly there's no spies that are sort of more prized than catching U.S. intelligence. And that's the one that's being presented to the Russian public.
What's the backstory on Paul Whelan? Who is he and what was he doing in Moscow?
Mr. Whelan is a retired Marine. He was in law enforcement for some time. We know through his company. He's the director of global security for a company called BorgWarner that provides technologies for combustion engines, hybrid and electric vehicles, that sort of thing. He oversees security at Auburn Hills, Michigan plant. But he's also in charge of the company's sites globally. And the company has a big global footprint with offices in China, Eastern Europe, throughout Western Europe, although it's important to note not in Russia. But he has traveled to Russia several times for business and pleasure. And he was in Moscow for this wedding party, as you noted in your intro.
His family has released a statement saying they're worried for Whelan's safety. Is there grounds for their concern?
Well, certainly Russian prisons are no fun places to be, and there are plenty of stories that we've heard over the years of bad things happening. But I think once you're a high-profile prisoner, I think it's sort of hard to believe that his safety would be in jeopardy. I think the bigger issue here is, of course, the charges. Espionage carries a sentence of 10 to 20 years in prison. That's no laughing matter. And his family has noted that, you know, given Mr. Whelan's background as a former Marine, someone in law enforcement, someone in charge of global security for major corporations, you know, this idea that they say that he would be sort of conducting espionage or not be careful, they find laughable. So that they've insisting that he's completely innocent.
Charles, give us a little history, if possible, of past incidences involving U.S. citizens being arrested for espionage and how that compares to citizens from other countries facing similar situations.
Seems like we hear about spy cases all the time involving Russia and the U.S., but if you actually are looking for the arrest of U.S. spies in Russia, you know, we'd have to go back to 2013. That's when a U.S. diplomat named Ryan Fogel was arrested and expelled after being accused of trying to recruit a Russian intelligence officer as a spy. The case may stick out in some people's minds, not so much for the charges as much as how it was carried out. Mr. Fogel was arrested and sort of perp walked on national television here wearing a wig, a baseball hat, a fake mustache, and a compass. So it almost seemed like something out of this Beastie Boys sabotage video clip, I think, that most people have probably seen. But if you go to some other cases, you have to go back into 2000. There was the case of the former naval intelligence officer, Edmund Pope. And he was tried and convicted of espionage, but later pardoned by President Putin, of course, was still in office. I think the more relevant case may be the case of Frode Berg. He's a Norwegian national. He was a retired former guard on the Russian-Norwegian border. And he's currently in custody in Russia, awaiting trial on charges of espionage for being a courier for the Norwegian military intelligence.
I can't help thinking about Maria Butina, the Russian who was recently convicted in a U.S. court, and whether there's a tit-for-tat going on here.
Well, that's one of the other theories involved here. Ms. Butina was convicted for operating as a foreign agent for a foreign government, of course, the Russian government, and she admitted to those charges in court in the U.S. The issue is the Russian side. Vladimir Putin has said that he doesn't know who she is. Now, you can believe that or not, but there is a certain rule where the Russian and U.S. relationship works where there's usually parity involved. In other words, you do something, we do something. What's interesting here is that you have a charge of espionage, which is seemingly a lot more serious than the charge of operating as an undeclared foreign agent, as Ms. Butina was.
But couldn't there be a scenario where they're swapped?
Absolutely. You certainly would think that, that might be a possibility, although you might also think about the fact that there are other high-profile Russian prisoners in the U.S. penal system right now that the Russians might be interested in trading for.
What's the next step for Paul Whelan?
Well, we know that the State Department and the embassy here in Moscow, the U.S. embassy, they've been notified, of course, by the foreign ministry of Mr. Whelan's detention. They've asked for access to him, and the assumption is that they'll get that in the coming hours. But, of course, this is the New Year's holiday. The whole country kind of goes in this grand national slumber. So I don't suspect we'll hear too much information for the next week or so, but certainly we'll be looking for it.
Reporter Charles Maines speaking to us from Moscow. Happy New Year, Charles.
Happy New Year, Carol. Thanks so much.
We can only take a guess. That phrase can apply to an awful lot of questions involving Russia and its president, Vladimir Putin, including what's up with those calendars? Seriously. Here's the world's Lucy Martirosyan.
So imagine Vladimir Putin topless in the woods with a gun. Next month, he's fishing in a white button-down shirt and pants. Now, these aren't pictures from the Russian president's eHarmony page. They're photos from a Vladimir Putin calendar. I know, because we have one here in the newsroom.
I saw this calendar on the wall, and I was really impressed, and it was a little bit funny for me.
Tatiana lives in Moscow. She wasn't expecting to see a calendar of her president on our wall when she visited a few months back, even though they're popular in Russia.
Especially calendars with photos of Vladimir Putin doing some sport activities.
Tatiana says she knows people who put up calendars and portraits of Putin as a joke, usually in the office. But in some more rural regions, people are completely serious about it. Putin's almost like a religious icon there.
They really feel that Putin is a powerful man.
I tried to figure out who sells these calendars. It's not easy. They're mostly sold from Russia on eBay and Amazon. I contacted one seller on eBay who didn't want to use his real name, so I'll call him Captain. He told me that Putin calendar sales spike after media coverage. And Western media does love to review these calendars every year.
Nice, doesn't it? I can't believe a whole year has gone by since the Putin 2016 calendar.
The Vladimir Putin 2017 calendar is out, and it's packed with Putin.
Well, it's the 2019 Vladimir Putin calendar. The calendars are part of a campaign.
You get the point. But for some, the calendars look like a Kremlin publicity stunt. Mira Kuznetsov owns Books and Arts in Brookline, Massachusetts. It's a small shop that's filled to the brim with Russian books. There are even workbooks to learn the language, hand-painted matryoshka dolls and traditional gel pottery. But there are absolutely no calendars of Vladimir Putin.
Calendars?
Yeah.
She's laughing, but she doesn't find the Russian president funny at all.
I know why I don't like him. I used to live in New York. It was a story with a submarine, if you remember Kursk.
She tells me about the Kursk, the Russian submarine disaster of August 2000. She remembers watching it on TV from her apartment in New York as Vladimir Putin, who was president at that time too, rejected aid from other governments. And then it was too late. There were no survivors. All 118 people aboard died. Mira thought of him as heartless after that. She says the calendars remind her of how Russian state media try to make Putin look like a man of the people. But outside of Russia, it seems like a lot of people see the calendars differently. Again, like a joke. In Japan, for example, This year's Putin calendars are outselling calendars featuring local celebrities. So maybe this is more about a kind of strongman nostalgia happening around the world. After all, in Italy, calendars of fascist dictator Benito Mussolini have made a comeback for 2019. And in Russia, Putin may have some competition this year from Joseph Stalin. Calendars of the former Soviet leader are suddenly in demand again. And that's definitely not a joke. For The World, I'm Lucy Martirosyan.
With or without a Putin calendar on the wall, a lot of people with Russian roots were celebrating the new year big time last night. Among them, our own Daniel Offman and his family. And as we'll hear, Putin was involved with that too.
New Year's is a big deal in my family. My parents, my sisters, my grandparents, we all come together at my grandparents' house. We all sit around a table. We have lots of herring. We have caviar. And yeah, we're drinking a lot. That's another big part of it. Oh my God. So we had a toast, multiple toasts of 2018, kind of recapping the year. So that's two, our count is about two shots of vodka. Then we'll have a toast to my grandparents. We'll have a toast to my parents. That's another two. So we're at four shots of vodka. Then when we get to midnight and the ball comes down, we'll all drink champagne, so I guess that won't be part of the count. And then afterwards, we'll have multiple shots kind of saying, we hope we have a healthy 2019 and that everyone succeeds in whatever they're doing. So, like, around six or seven shots of vodka. And then afterwards, we watched Putin's address from Moscow.
Уважаемые граждане России! Дорогие друзья,
we watch Putin's address every year. It's kind of been a tradition in the Soviet Union and in Russia since Brezhnev. So it's this weird thing. Some people at the table are watching in admiration. Some people are kind of watching ironically and making fun the whole time. For me, when I'm sitting at the table, I'm not excited to hear what he had to say. He really said nothing. These kind of hollow words of like friendship and family and stuff like that. But it is what you do. Tradition's kind of tradition when it comes to the new year.
The World's Daniel Offman there. Vladimir Putin wasn't the only world leader to give a New Year's speech. So did Donald Trump. Via Twitter, of course.
We're going to win. We're going to win all the way. We're going to win at everything we do. So happy new year, and let's enjoy the next year, and then we're going to enjoy the following year, and then we have four more, and everything is going to be so beautiful.
In case you missed it, Trump also tweeted a written message that said, happy new year to everyone, including the haters and the fake news media. Aw. So we thought we'd play you a few samples of New Year's messages from other leaders around the world. Kim Jong-un in North Korea gave his speech from a leather armchair. He spoke mostly about the economy. He also said he was ready for another meeting with Trump. But he somewhat cryptically warned that he'd have to take a new path if the U.S. keeps up sanctions. Meanwhile, over in France... Yep, that's how President Macron's New Year's message began. He talked about the divisions and anger gripping his country.
Colère contre les injustices.
Anger, he says, against injustice, against globalization, which can be incomprehensible at times. Anger against an administrative system that is too complex. Macron didn't mention the yellow vest protesters by name, though that's who he was talking about. And then there's Theresa May's message. The British Prime Minister focused on, you guessed it, Brexit.
The Brexit deal I have negotiated delivers on the vote of the British people. In the next few weeks, MPs will have an important decision to make. If Parliament backs the deal, Britain can turn a corner.
Doesn't sound too excited about it. Just a sample there of messages from leaders around the world on this New Year's Day. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. He's been called the Donald Trump of the tropics, and today he too became president. Jair Bolsonaro, an anti-establishment former army captain, was sworn in today as president of Brazil, and his fans were out in force in the streets of Brasilia. Many in the raucous crowds waved and pointed their fingers in the shape of a gun, using Bolsonaro's trademark gesture. Reporter Shannon Sims has lived in Brazil for more than a decade and watched today's events unfold.
the president with his wife, Michelle, the new First Lady of Brazil, went through waving. And along the way, normally you would have a lot of visiting dignitaries at an inauguration. This wasn't about that. This was more about Bolsonaro reaching out to his main fan base. They turned out in order to see him. In fact, it was so hot in Brazil that the fire trucks ended up blasting them all with water in order to cool them down.
Wow. And remind us, who are Bolsonaro's biggest fans?
This is similar to how Trump's fan base is in the U.S. Their number one priority is taking care of their family, attending a religious service, and keeping those conservative values in the forefront. The platform that he really won on in Brazil that really resonated for a lot of people was violence. Brazil has experienced an extreme wave of violence in the past few years, and they haven't really been able to get a grip on it. That's what he's promised to do.
Just days before Bolsonaro put on his presidential sash, his son and social media manager Carlos shared a sort of pump-up video with clips from his father. Let's play a bit, and then you can tell us what the video is about.
Ah, mataram 60 mil. Eu queria que matasse 200 mil vagabundos.
This video was posted by his son Carlos, who's essentially his social media manager. And it's interesting because what they've done is he's taken clips of Bolsonaro's most controversial statements, statements that the leftists in Brazil have criticized. And he's made like a montage of them as something to be proud of. And so in that video, Bolsonaro is saying, oh, yeah, you say they killed 60,000. He's referring to the homicide rate in Brazil. Oh, yeah, you say they killed 60,000. I think they should have killed 200,000 of the thieves that we have here. He's criticizing Congress for not taking stronger action in allowing policemen to have broad leverage in order to stop crime in Brazil. And then he comes back at them. He says, I don't even think you guys are concerned about public safety. You're acting like little girls. You're acting like an expletive, but it is essentially a word for the female anatomy that Trump was caught using in that Access Hollywood tape.
Like Trump, does support for Bolsonaro come from often areas of Brazil that have been left out of the economy and more rural areas, or is it as many urban supporters as not?
That is one way that I would say that Bolsonaro differs from Trump. Brazil doesn't have what we would call like a middle America. And so instead, Bolsonaro's support actually comes from a lot of people in the upper classes who are supporting him not just for his stances on violence, but also his stances on the economy. Brazil's economy has been in a total nosedive. And so they are looking for somebody who, literally anybody, who can maybe turn the ship around. So they voted for him for that reason. And then his other support actually comes from a religious base. So the evangelical church in Brazil has just been booming in the past generation. And those people, he was able to use. I actually interviewed a woman in the deep Amazon during the campaign. And I said, you're poor, you're indigenous, you're a woman, you're of color. Why are you voting for Bolsonaro? Everything that's on your demographic profile says that you shouldn't. And she says, he's the only one that used the name of God in his campaign. And I think that that was the truth for a lot of Brazilian voters.
Reporter Shannon Sims in Rio de Janeiro on day one of the new presidency of Jair Bolsonaro. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Among the changes that Jair Bolsonaro has promised to bring to Brazil is an end to same-sex marriage. It's been legal in Brazil since 2013, and in the run-up to today's inauguration, there's been a surge in same-sex marriages there. Carolina Zanatta and Aline Fogel are among the many couples that rush to tie the knot. I spoke with them from their home in Sao Paulo earlier today. Aline told me they got married in early December.
We were planning to get married, but we hurry up because of the elections and the winning of Bolsonaro. Not just us, but a lot of couples got married.
I'm curious, how did you two meet?
We met by a friend 3 years ago. He told that I was perfect to Carolina. And
and so that turned out to be true.
Yes.
Aline, I wanted to ask you a question, and if you could ask it to Carolina, and she could answer in Portuguese, then you can translate for us.
Okay.
Legal experts seem to believe that Bolsonaro will end same-sex marriage. How worried are you that that will happen?
A gente tem um medo de que mudanças de fato ocorram, porque no Brasil o que garante hoje, né, o casamento entre pessoas do mesmo sexo...
Ok. I'm afraid because today gay marriage is legal, but it can turn illegal. So we got scared of this.
I understand. Eleni, I wanted to ask you, have you felt any difference in the way you and other people in the LGBTQ community have been treated since Bolsonaro launched his presidential campaign or and since he was elected?
Yes. What I talk with Carolina is that sometimes we are afraid of just walking together with our hands, our keys, one another, and be attacked because of that.
So you walk together, but you don't hold hands?
No, we hold hands, but sometimes we're afraid. We thought that this had finished, and after this, I don't know.
Things were getting better in Brazil in terms of the rights and freedom of gay and lesbian people in Brazil, and now things feel like it's getting worse.
Yeah, exactly.
Is Bolsonaro and the new kind of renewed anti-gay climate in Brazil, is it affecting where you want to live in the future or whether you're going to have kids?
Yes, we plan to live in Portugal.
You're moving to Portugal?
Yeah. Language is the same and it's not Brazil.
Did you decide to move to Portugal after Bolsonaro was elected?
We were thinking about, but now is almost a fact. We don't know how things can get changed here, and we are planning to do this.
I've been speaking to Eleni Fogel. She and Carolina Zanata got married. They're among many gay couples in Brazil who rushed to the altar before Bolsonaro took office today. The new Brazilian president has promised to end gay marriage in the country. Thank you both and best of luck.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
I'm Carol Hills. Starting today, single-use plastic bags are banned in Jamaica, and some businesses there are left literally holding the bags.
You know, the restaurants yesterday were really trying to get rid of that stuff because the government has stated that there will be no exemptions, there will be no grace period.
Jamaica's bag ban, ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. If you go into a supermarket or drugstore here in Boston, you won't be able to leave with one of those thin, single-use plastic bags anymore. The city banned them as of a couple of weeks ago, joining a growing list of cities and towns across the country that are banning single-use plastic items. Elsewhere, whole countries are getting into the act, and not just rich ones. The latest ban goes into effect today in Jamaica. Suzanne Stanley is with the Jamaica Environment Trust in Kingston.
We do have a plastic pollution crisis in Jamaica. So it's not just the plastic bags, you know, everything plastic. Single-use plastic is littering our streets, littering our coastline. Plastic bags make up, of course, a portion of that. But we're also talking about plastic bottles, you know, cutlery, food and beverage containers, or styrofoam. Lots and lots of plastic pollution, which causes an endless amount of problems for our environment and for public health.
Today is New Year's Day. It's also day one of the ban. Are there any stores open to even test how it's working?
It is a public holiday in Jamaica, so the real test will be tomorrow. I must say, though, that last night I got takeout, and I have never received so many plastic bags with my takeout as I did last night. So it's obvious that, you know, the restaurants, the retailers yesterday were really trying to get rid of that stock because the government has stated that there will be no exemptions, there will be no grace period. Whatever you have in stock, as a distributor, as a retailer, wholesaler, you will no longer be allowed to distribute as of today, as of January 1st.
Are those the ones that are called scandal bags?
Those are the ones that are called scandal bags, yes. There's several local terms for them. Scandal bags is by far the most popular. They are also referred to as T-shirt bags, and as a lot of bags in some parts of the country.
So sometimes people use those for good reasons. You know, fruit sellers may not be able to sell a whole pineapple, but they can sell part of one, and or people need plastic to protect something.
I mean, what I've been thinking about, I said, well, how am I going to get cotton melon? Right. Because, you know, I'm a two person household. It's just my husband and I don't ever want a huge melon. I just want maybe half of a melon or a quarter of a melon. And what I'm thinking is, OK, what I'll have to do now is take a Tupperware container. So a large Tupperware, you know, reusable container to my market lady and ask her to put the cut melon in that instead. So, I mean, there are ways around it. It just takes a little brain power thinking about it. But we are very a very ingenious society.
So this is a big change because they used to get them for free.
Right, right. It is a big cultural shift, right? And that is one of the things that, you know, going into this new year, this new age in Jamaica, where, you know, we're trying to transition away from plastics. It's very, very important that we do that. And it is in line with global trends and, you know, but it is a bold move by the government, right? And we are concerned that there could be negative repercussions from removing this free source of garbage bags from the society and not doing enough education and enforcement around the ban, especially as it relates to the containerization of garbage. You know, we do fear that in the absence of these free sources of garbage bags, that people will just throw their loose garbage in a bin, which makes it significantly more difficult for the garbage collection service to collect. And it also does lead to things like the bins being turned over, the garbage spreading around, public health issues, the garbage ending up in our drains, in our gullies. You know, there's all kinds of scenarios that you can think of when your garbage is not packaged properly.
How do you feel about being from a country that's taken this step? It's a move that many large countries, including the U.S., isn't even close to.
I feel very proud of Jamaica taking action. It is necessary action. You know, our largest income earner in Jamaica is tourism. And the most visible signs of the plastic pollution problem is on our coasts, right? The garbage that is being carelessly discarded on land makes its way down to our coastline via rivers, gullies, you know, you name it, drains, and it washes up on our coastline. And when you think about a country that we're so heavily dependent on tourism as an income earner, just beyond the environmental and public health issues associated with plastics, you know, the economic implications that would have on our country, you know, we could be essentially shooting ourselves in the foot by allowing this to continue. So I think it's great. I think it's a very bold action, you know, but this is just one part of the puzzle. Eh? There's lots of other things that are much needed to improve our solid waste management. But this is a very bold first step in that direction.
Suzanne Stanley is with the Jamaica Environment Trust in Kingston, talking to us about a new ban on some plastics material in Jamaica, which takes effect today, New Year's Day. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
We're going to take a few minutes now to hear the story of two brothers and a bunch of names. The brothers are immigrants to the U.S., but they've been here so long that when you hear them speak, you might take them for native-born Americans. Their names don't give much away either, at least the names they took while working in a family-run restaurant.
I went through several names before Tony came about, actually.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes, yes.
What were you, Giuseppe?
I was James. James for a while.
James.
Yeah. And Jasser.
Jasser.
Jasser was another name.
Okay.
But it just didn't quite click until this one other girl came in one time and she said, "What's your name?" And I said, "Guess." And she said, "Tony." And I said, "Yes, you're right."
That was it.
That was it.
New name, clean slate. Except, of course, it didn't quite turn out that way. We're going to let Tara Shalal pick up the story now. She's Tony's daughter, and her story comes to us from the podcast Kerning Cultures.
It all started with being at home with my dad and just kind of asking him about how he and his brother came up with these second names that they go by.
My name, Yasser Shalal, and I used to go by Tony at times.
That's my dad.
My name is Enes Shalal. I go by Andy.
That's my uncle. So we're sitting around the coffee table at my uncle's farmhouse in Virginia in the U.S. on a late summer day. We're sipping chai, and over the course of a few weeks, I bring my family together like this on different occasions, and I pull out my recorder.
We came to the United States in 1966.
That's my Uncle Ennis.
I was 10 at the time, and my brother was, I think, 18.
I was 12.
We came from Iraq. My father was sent here as a representative for the Arab League, and he was stationed here in Washington, D.C., and we were going to be here for just a short period of time, but we ended up staying here and making America our home.
The Arab League is this mini UN of 20-plus Arab countries. My grandfather was working for the Arab League until 1968, when the Iraq regime changed. And given that his work was really tied to the new, now obsolete government, my grandfather made the decision to make the States a permanent home for his family.
We've been here over 50 years.
For my dad and uncle, young boys at the time, this meant a cultural shift. Here's my dad, Yasser, again.
And came at a rather early age in middle school. It was quite a challenge getting to know kids and what have you.
Well, the English we learned in Iraq was very rudimentary. It was probably three or four sentences. Basically, we spoke no English at all. In fact, the school we went to, the middle school, Stratford Junior High School, was pretty diverse. Actually, the school had, it was black and white for the most part. There wasn't a lot of others.
So imagine yourself as a 10 or 12-year-old moving to a foreign country, speaking little to no English, and being the first and only Arabs in the school. On top of that, you have names that are difficult to pronounce. And like so many kids who go through junior high, they got used to the teasing and moved on. But when they got to high school, things changed.
And truth be told, it came about because we owned a restaurant.
That's it.
After his work with the Arab League came to an end, my grandfather, Ahmed Shalal, set up a pizza parlor called Pizza Gazzano in Virginia in the U.S. My dad was 16 and my uncle was 14 when they started working at the pizza parlor after school.
It was a formica top, circular stools that are stationary into the ground. They had speckles of silver on them. The walls were of velvet, big carpets of Elvis or some other iconic figure. There was a big jukebox that sat in one corner.
We would get high school kids. We would also get neighborhood families. Very much a American staple in most cities, almost.
And I remember the day that happened, we had that regular customer, the guy that sat there and drank all day. Anyway, he sat there. Every time he would come, he would ask, "What's your name? What's your name?" And we try to explain our name. And every time we say it, he mispronounces it, or he can't hear it, or he doesn't understand it. Finally, he said, "You know what? I'm going to start calling you Andy." And it was like, okay, that seems like much easier. And Andy, of course, sounds like an Italian name, a person that belongs in an Italian restaurant. And it seemed odd that you'd have an Ennis and a Yasser serving pizza, lasagna, and pasta. So we became Andy and Tony. We made fun of him. We call him Tony. So we made fun of each other by our other name.
Back then, the only Arabs my dad and his brother interacted with were family friends, which were only very few. You have to remember, in the 1960s, there were only about 80,000 Arabs living in the U.S. out of a population of 196 million.
And I think as you got older and as you got your circles grew wider and intersected with each other, it became more complicated.
For instance, you know, when I would sign a contract with somebody and they would know me by Tony, and then I would have to sign it in my Arabic name. That's always like, how come you signed it this way and it's that? That happened when I got married.
Were you Tony when you got married, or were you Yasser?
It was Yasser.
And then Tony appeared.
Well, it was accidental.
That is Emel Shalal, also known as my mom.
After we got married, like a month after we got married, we just had a party for all his friends, introducing me to them. And as I was bringing the food on the table, one of his friends pulled him aside and said, "Tony, why does she keep calling you Yasser?" So that was the time when it wasn't awkward, but it was different.
It's sometimes harder to explain it to the Arab component than it is to the American component. because my given name is Yasser. When you're changing it, you're almost like, not betraying, but it's a bit of a compromise.
I remember when we first came here, when I hear somebody from the Middle East has an Americanized name, I think, why are they doing that? That seems really silly. And it feels like something is wrong, like you're hiding something, and now I'm doing it. So I feel awkward about it, no question about it. I think it has to do with how you carry your name.
Sure.
If you have a confidence about your name and you correct people when they make fun of it and you tell them not to do that, I think people have a lot of respect for you and are willing to go along with it. For me, at this point, I really want to change back to Enes, but it's very difficult. If I had to do it over again, I wouldn't change it. If I do it over again, I would keep my name and struggle through the process and come out, I think, stronger and better on the other side. I think it was a little bit of a cop-out to give up the name.
To change my name now would be just confusing. And honestly, I'm not that insecure, I guess, about my sense of who I am and my identity at this point, that I have to use my name as a way for me to, codify that. You know, I don't think I need that at this point.
I agree that having that name defended is probably the best way. And Amin's generation and your generation are in a much better position to do that. It took us 51 years to sort of allow the larger culture to get familiar with me as a person. Now, putting a label, Yasser or Tony, on that same person should not really alter the individual's perception of me. That's what I'm hoping has evolved over that period of time to pave the way, if you will, for opportunities for the younger and the newer immigrants and newer citizens in this country, and have the benefit of not having to completely be defensive about their name. And I think your name should be who you are.
That story was reported by Tara Shalal. It comes to us from Kerning Cultures, which produces podcasts from the Middle East. Their latest new episode traces the little-known connections between Yemen and Vietnam, told through the story of a single family. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. 2018 is behind us, and three of Europe's top political leaders are probably happy to see it go. One is President Emmanuel Macron of France. His popularity crashed late in the year as tens of thousands of protesters in yellow vests demanded that he step down. Another is Britain's Prime Minister, Theresa May. Her government descended into chaos after her deal to leave the European Union was widely panned. And in Germany, Chancellor Angela Merkel became a lame duck after losing control of her party. All of these leaders are entering 2019 presiding over countries that, like the U.S., are deeply divided. Also, like in the U.S., the divisions go way beyond politics. Stanford University political scientist Francis Fukuyama has been thinking a lot about this. His new book is called Identity, The Demand for Dignity, and the Politics of Resentment. Francis Fukuyama, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
You've given me a new word to learn. In Greek, it's spelled T-H-Y-M-O-S. What is it?
Thumos, yes. Well, it's usually translated in English as spiritedness, but it really refers to the part of human psychology that demands respect.
And how does it apply to the troubles in France, the UK, and Germany?
Well, I think that a lot of the populist revolt that's been going on in all of the countries you mentioned, the Brexit voters that wanted to get out of the European Union, saw their country filling up with foreigners, which they blamed on the EU. In France, the Yellow Jacket movement are people that don't live in Paris, aren't these cosmopolitan types that benefit from globalization, and they felt that the gas price hike was hurting them. And finally, in Germany, there was a big backlash to Angela Merkel's welcoming of Syrian refugees in 2015 by a lot of ordinary Germans that felt that this was going to change their national culture and their national identity in ways that they didn't like, and the elites weren't listening to them. And in all of those cases, you had groups of voters that felt they weren't being listened to, they were invisible to the elites. That's why they were angry, and that's why they went out to either vote or protest in the way that they did.
How do identity politics in the U.S. differ from the examples you mentioned in Europe?
In a certain way, the sociology is the same. And so you have a similar group of people that live in less populated areas that haven't benefited and, in fact, have actually been hurt by globalization. You know, the job loss and the outsourcing and deindustrialization that's occurred in many kind of industrial heartland states. So that's similar. What's different, I think, though, is what American identity is to begin with, because the U.S. was always a much more diverse country than all of the countries, especially those in Western Europe, that actually had a single religion and a single ethnic identity. The United States started out that way, but as you had successive waves of immigration, we became much more diverse, and I think Americanism began to reflect that diversity.
You're concerned about identity politics. Let's take the U.S. What concerns you?
The reason I wrote this book on identity was that you've now seen the rise of a right-wing identity politics. If you want to know what that means, just look at the behavior of Donald Trump before the November 6th midterm election. He was advised to campaign on his tax cuts and the fact that the economy was doing great. And instead, all we heard about was this horrible migrant caravan and taking away birthright citizenship and sending the military to the border to protect us from these terrorists trying to get into the country. I mean, that's really an example of what we mean by identity politics, or shifting the conversation away from economic policy to these identity issues. And I just think it's very hard to have a democracy under those conditions. It feeds the polarization in the country, which I think is our single biggest vulnerability right now.
I'll come back to the U.S., but I want to ask about some countries where identity politics, they don't seem to be a factor. I'm thinking of China, Japan, or South Korea. Why aren't identity politics taking hold there?
Well, I think partly because they're not that diverse. In all of those countries, you had a very distinctive national identity that was formed, you know, hundreds of years ago. In China's case, a couple millennia ago. And you've had a, you know, homogenization, an ethnic homogenization of those populations. And then further, they don't permit immigration. None of those countries welcomes immigrants. And so as a result, you don't have the kind of ethnic cleavages that exist in immigrant communities in Western democracies, and therefore you don't have the backlash movement. But you do have a certain form of populism. I think that all of those countries, in a sense, do have a certain craving for strong leadership that has some similarities to the things that are going on in other parts of the world.
When you talk about the kind of lean toward a sort of strong government leadership, are you thinking of that historically or as part of the trend that we're witnessing now in places that used to not be strong leaders and now the sort of trend toward populism and authoritarianism?
No, this is absolutely part of the current trend. I think that one of the characteristics of populist politics is charismatic leadership. This means that the leader establishes a personal relationship between himself or herself and the people, and that makes them anti-institutional. And that's the real threat, I think, to democracy, because democracy is not just about getting elected by voters. It's also about a constitutional system that limits power through a system of checks and balances. And virtually all of the new populist leaders that have arisen, like Viktor Orban in Hungary, for example, have been anti-institutional in that sense. They don't like the courts. They don't like a critical media. They don't like anything that gets in the way of their agenda. And therefore, they try to dismantle it. And I'm sorry to say, but our president is the prime example of this.
Do you ever worry that liberal democracy, as we've known it, is kind of on the way out? We're kind of slowly evolving into something else here in the United States. Or do you think that's kind of overblown?
I definitely worry that the quality of our democracy is decaying. This is something that had started, you know, way before the 2016 election, I think, with the rise of money in politics and the, you know, the increasing polarization of the political system. It's just not been functioning properly. But I do think that the country has been through worse patches. Like the period before the Civil War was pretty bad, and it actually led to the country falling apart. And yet the country managed to get through that. And I think you're seeing already a kind of blowback to the blowback emerging. I think the November 6th election was a repudiation of Trump's brand of populist politics, and hopefully that's a trend that will continue.
Francis Fukuyama's new book is Identity, the Demand for Dignity and the Politics of Resentment. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you very much.
That's it from us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. And from all of us at The World, Happy New Year.
PRI, Public Radio International.